Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome. I recently spoke with Nathan Hesselink about his new book, Samul Nori, Contemporary Korean Drumming and the Rebirth of Itinerant Performance Culture. The University of Chicago Press published that in 2012. Now, I loved reading this book for so many reasons. It's not only really interesting and really smooth to read. He's a very good writer and a very clear arguer and very compelling arguer, but it's also just an inherently fascinating case study. So if you're interested in the history of East Asian studies or the contemporary studies of East Asia, it's a really wonderful window into Korean history, Korean pop culture, and Korean musical culture. But also, if you're just more broadly interested in music, it's a really deep study, but without feeling that it's overwhelmingly technical, of a part of musical culture that you may not know much about. And really helpfully for me, as somebody who didn't know much about the history of drumming, of Korean drumming at all before I came to this study, there's a CD in the back of the book that includes examples of a lot of the pieces that he very helpfully leads us through and that he talks about in the book so that you can listen along while you're reading. It's totally fascinating. It immediately made me want to go out and watch YouTube videos and get CDs of a lot of the groups that he talks about, and that the collaborations rather that he talks about in the book. And it was a lot of fun to talk with him about it. So I highly recommend reading the book, learning more about the drumming culture of contemporary Korea that he talks about in the book, and kicking back and listening not only to the interview, but also to the music that the interview is about. It's wonderful, and I hope you enjoy. We're here today to talk with Nathan Hesselink about his new book, Samul Nori, Contemporary Korean Drumming and the Rebirth of Itinerant Performance Culture. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Nathan, and thank you so much for making the time to talk with me today.
Great, thanks for having me.
So, Nathan, could you start us off by saying just a little bit about your background? What brought you to the field of ethnomusicology of Korea in the first place?
Yeah, I guess in a nutshell, my parents were missionaries in Japan, so I grew up in Japan until I was six, but really all my older brothers and sisters were born and raised in Japan, and even when we moved back to the U.S., we were kind of the strange household in this otherwise basically all Dutch community that had all this Japanese culture in it, so music and art, and whenever basically any Japanese people were within about 100 miles of my parents' house, they would somehow, you know, work their way into our living room, and so growing up, I just always had this deep connection with Japan, and after college, actually went and taught English, like many people do, in Japan, kind of trying to reconnect with Japan on an adult level. So that's kind of the East Asian background. And from there, discovered Japanese traditional music. And that's really what my MA and my introduction to ethnomusicology was, through Japanese traditional music. So that's my first kind of taste of non-Western music and my introduction to that. When I finished my MA, I went back to Japan to do really extensive field work in this particular, it's actually a female vocal genre, which is a very long story. It's geisha songs, which was my master's thesis. But I went to study with a geisha teacher and learn the vocal art and the music. And while I was in Japan, I was able to travel to Korea. And during that time, I actually heard Samul Nori. It wasn't the original Samul Nori group. It was the National Center Samul Nori group. And it was really almost literally within about a 20-minute segment of time that I discovered that Korean percussion was really what I wanted to pursue, you know, for the PhD, and hence how I found my way into it. But so it was kind of a long, meandering way into Korean traditional music, but it was really through Japan, which I think many of my colleagues, I think, in Korean studies also kind of discovered Korea through Japan as well.
And didn't you mention in the book that it was actually kind of on a lark that you wound up getting to that performance of Korean traditional music in the first place? It was, you were actually in Korea to renew a visa or something.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. I was getting a slightly better teaching job in Japan, which would give me more time to take lessons. I wasn't a particularly good English teacher. During that time, I had to leave the country, and my then fiance, I mean, we're married now, but she had family in Seoul. And so I had a place to stay, and I was just in Seoul. It was my first time to Korea, and I was there for a week, and it was the last day. In fact, I think it was July 4th, if I'm not mistaken. My future sister-in-law said, oh, you know, you're into traditional music of Japan. Well, that's really great, but, you know, you should come hear Korean traditional music. She was a little bit nationalistic. So I said, sure, that's great. You know, I don't know anything about Korean traditional music, almost nothing. And so she invited me to this program, this afternoon concert, and it was the last piece on this program, which was really designed for foreigners and I think Korean school children, to introduce Korean traditional music. And it was about a, you know, 8-9 minute performance of the resident Samulnori team. So you're right. It was really the tail end of a visit, almost by accident or on a lark, as you say. And that in many ways really made all the difference.
Now, the book that we are talking about today looks at a kind of Korean percussion music as embodied in a particular group, the Samulnori group in 20th century Korea. Can you talk a little bit about how you eventually came to this topic from your original interest in traditional Korean percussion music and in your previous work on traditional Korean music?
Yeah, I mean, as I actually point out in the introduction to this book, my initial interest was actually in Samulnori, which, you know, we may talk about this more in detail in a little bit here, but it's essentially a kind of contemporary urban reworking of a much older sort of amateur-based traditional percussion, you know, folk percussion tradition. And so, you know, I was able to go to Korea in 93 and 94 for a workshop, and I really wanted to study this more recent Samulnori phenomenon. And a number of people basically steered me clear of that, saying, well, if you really want to study what's traditional, or at least what's older in Korea, you should study this older folk drumming tradition, which is known by a number of names. But so it's really, and then I decided, well, yeah, okay, that I guess that makes sense. And I do want to know sort of what's been around, I guess, before I look at sort of contemporary culture or visions or re-envisioning of this tradition. So that's how I got into Korean folk percussion, which is known as pungmul or nongak or pungmulgu. There are all these various indigenous terms. But so that's what I ended up doing for my PhD work, was living out in the countryside, working with rural performers for the most part, though also with a few semi-professional performers, and really trying to figure out what Korean folk percussion meant kind of in the late 20th century. I mean, I tried to do some historical work, and that comes out in this most recent book as well, but really the dissertation was focused on trying to document what was going on in the late 20th century and musically, so little of the music had been written down or notated. And so that's how I got into Korean folk percussion. And then once I'd spent many years after the dissertation and teaching the ensemble and everything, I kept remembering back to that performance that I had seen, you know, back in 92, I think, of Samulnori that one summer. And kind of on the sly, really, started writing about Samulnori and collecting recordings and all of this on the side without really talking to a lot of people about it, but just sort of thinking, well, I'm going to somehow do something with Samulnori. And to be honest, I kept thinking someone would publish a book on them. I mean, they've been popular for so long, and they've been in the media for so long, and if most people, if they know anything about Korean music, it's only Samulnori. Mostly I was just being polite. I had a lot of grad school friends who were writing dissertations on Samulnori, and I kept thinking, you know, every year, okay, a book's going to come out, a book's going to come out. 8 years clack by, 9 years clack by. But, well, you know, I'm growing old here waiting for this book to come out. And so, I mean, I'm oversimplifying this a little bit, but I decided I'd collected enough, and I talked to people and had my brain wrapped around a way of organizing this book. And so that's eventually how this book comes out. But my interest in Samulnori is actually older than the folk percussion sort of version or variant of the tradition. And it's just something I've kept on a back burner, you know, up until quite recently.
Well, the book itself, the introduction itself, and this is, this, among many other things, this alone is worth the price of admission, but it opens up with this beautiful quote about children of wandering minstrels. And so I just want to mention that before we move on to just direct listeners. When you do, listeners, pick up a copy of the book, and I hope that you do, it's wonderful. And the book itself, and we'll get to this later on as well, includes not just the text, but also an accompanying CD that features four of the musical pieces that are actually analyzed and discussed in the text itself. So it's a wonderful thing to have, and it's a wonderful object. But this quotation about children of wandering minstrels, I just loved, 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 and I had to stop there when I started reading the book and just take it in because it was so beautiful. But as we get into the book itself, the book, at least the introduction after this beautiful quote, opens with an account of the first concert in a cramped basement in Seoul in 1978 of an ensemble that called themselves Samulnori. So there are, to get us started, and we've already used this term and talked a little bit about your interest in Samul Nori, but let's lay the foundation here for what's to come by talking a little bit about what this is. There are two Samul Noris in the book. There's the group named Samul Nori, and there's the larger musical category that the group is part of that you talk about in the context of a more general term, Samul Nori. So the same kind of word, written a little bit differently, in at least in English transcription. Let's lay the groundwork. So first, the category. Can you talk a little bit about this type of music, Samul Nori, and situate it as an art form in relation to other forms of traditional or folk Korean percussion music?
Yeah, this is maybe not the order you just asked for, but for me, it's going to go chronologically.
Sure.
So essentially, as you say in the introduction to the book, and then later in chapter two, which I guess we'll get to in a few moments, but really, this all was born of Korean traditional music culture in the 1970s. And to be very, very brief, and we'll talk more about this in a moment, but in the 1970s, essentially you have a number of kind of nationalistic movements within Korea, within literature and art and drama and music, that are trying to preserve and promote Korean traditional music. Because 1970s is really when Western classical music, in terms of the construction of opera halls and orchestra halls and all this, come in. So that's kind of the context for a number of traditional musicians, not just in percussion, but in voice and theater and dance, are thinking of ways of modifying or going back to older roots, or somehow making this art form pertinent to audiences, particularly urban audiences of Korea, and Seoul being the largest city and the largest population in South Korea. And so that's the context for what Samul Nori is born out of. So in the kind of mid-1970s, Korean folk percussion is not particularly popular. In the countryside, it's doing all right, but the city, it's basically disappeared. And so you've got a number of young percussionists, late teens, early 20s, that are really thinking of many different ways of how can they re-envision folk percussion from the countryside, essentially into an urban context. Carla, I'm sorry, one second, I've got someone knocking on.
Okay, Nathan, sorry about that. So we're back after pausing very briefly, and also this gives me a chance to say happy birthday. And for listeners, there are apparently people with a cake and who have come to extend their birthday wishes. So now that we've done that, I'm sorry for the interruption. So you were in the middle of talking about the early context of Samul Nori and the development of this.
Yeah, so I was talking in particular about folk percussionists in the 1970s, particularly younger generations of folk percussionists, most of them from the countryside, who had moved to Seoul to look for work or to go to music conservatories or academies, and basically thinking of ways of re-envisioning. And there were many different strategies thought of in the 1970s about how could you get this countryside folk tradition kind of reinvigorated, particularly for people in concert hall culture, which is really a part of what I talk about in the second chapter. And so essentially there was a group of four young men who decided to essentially boil down this huge outdoor, raucous, amazing folk tradition into essentially putting chamber music onto a concert hall stage. And I know that's later chapters, so not to go into too much detail on that. But so essentially, Samul Nori represents the rethinking of this broad, outdoor, largely amateur-based, very long performances of loud, boisterous percussion music and dance into a much smaller, intimate space of the concert hall. And so when this sort of re-envisioning was happening in the 1970s, they needed to come up with a name to distinguish what they were doing. And a whole bunch of names were thrown out, even things like New Pungmul or New Nongak. Those were the old terms for folk percussion. And Samul Nori might sound kind of poetic if you don't speak Korean, but literally it's very descriptive in its designation. Samul just means four things, literally. But in this context, it refers to the four core percussion instruments, two drums and two gongs. And then Nori means, in the countryside way of thinking of it, it means kind of folk entertainment. So there are many kinds of Nori. So for example, tightrope walking is a kind of Nori. It's a kind of folk entertainment. Bowl spinning is a kind of folk entertainment. Puppet theater is a kind. And so there are reasons for this, which I guess we'll talk about maybe when talking about the first chapter and the Namsadang. But so they took this word Nori, that's very kind of meaning-laden, at least from the countryside and itinerant true performance culture, and linked it with Samul, meaning four instruments. So in now when we romanize this in English, it's usually in regular font, and the S and the N are capitalized, and that's the way that the group has designated it as the original group. And then to be very brief, an original group became so popular and really took over the traditional music world that by the early 1980s, there were a number of basically other groups mimicking or outright imitating the original Samuel group. And so it became so broad, it actually ended up becoming a genre. So today when we say Samuel it refers to a genre, which I've romanized as kind of as two words and an italics just to help readers distinguish between the two. So today, most people, when you say Samuel it refers to this genre of chamber music using these Korean traditional percussion instruments. And the original group is now named after the last of the original members still with them, Kim Dok-soo. And so it's called Kim Dok-soo Samuel-nori. So it's a little confusing, but that's really, you've got the original group and the genre.
Great. Thank you so much. So you talk a little bit at the beginning of the book about your decision to construct a very particular scope for the book. So even though this is a book about Samuel-nori, the group, you've decided to limit the scope to the first 20 years or so of the group's existence, which means not including a lot of what might otherwise fall under the rubric of a kind of modern history of this group. Can you talk a little bit about that choice and what you decided not to write about when you were constructing the framework that ultimately became the book?
Yeah, well, first of all, I should preface this by saying that most of my other writing on Korea or Japan has never really taken that much of a historical approach. And so that idea initially to frame this kind of historically or somewhat chronologically was new for me. And so that was a kind of first choice because I thought it would make the most sense. Though the book does jump around in time a little bit. And then secondly, I started thinking about all of the issues, and when you look at the Korean academic scholarship that's written about Samuel-nori, as well as sort of the journalistic stuff, there's just so much out there, and there's so many different angles. And so it was also an easier way, not easy, but easier way for me to kind of get a handle on this, to limit myself to that first 20 years, because so much happened in that first 20 years. And it's also kind of, it also describes its height of popularity. And there are a number of other things that kind of ended right at about the 20-year mark. And so for me, for me were a lot of these really kind of central issues that each of the chapters are organized around, all of them happened within that first 20 years. And in many ways, I feel, even though there are many new developments of the genre, and even with the original group, I think for people trying to understand, if they haven't read anything in English on Samuel-nori, or to understand its place and how it came about, which there still isn't a lot written about it in English. That's sort of why I decided to do that. In terms of what I chose not to address, there are a bunch of things. First, I didn't really talk much about reception history. I talk a little bit about what local drummers feel about it and what some of the original performers feel about it in the media, but that's really a whole different study. And in fact, there's, if I can do a little shout out for a friend in Bali, there's a woman, Catherine Lee, who received her PhD from Harvard just last year, and she's now a new assistant professor at UC Davis. Her dissertation at Harvard was on reception history of Samuel-nori, and she actually worked in their office for a couple of years back in the 90s, and she really talks about kind of all the political and these other ramifications of what happened when Samuel-nori converted this countryside thing to the stage. And so that's also a really fascinating study, which will eventually get published as well. So I chose not to talk so much about that. And there's also a lot of really sensational stories. It would have been easy to make this book, well, you don't think of academic books as being sexy, but I really made this more interesting in a way. I talked about the four original members, what people are now kind of a misnomer, but the four most famous of the kind of founders of the group, they have really tremendous stories in terms of drug usage and groupies and incarceration and, you know, power plays and all the kinds of things that you would follow maybe with a rock band or something. And so I just really didn't want to sensationalize any of that information. And then the last aspect, although there are many I didn't talk about, I didn't talk that much about kind of the gendering of the performers and everything. It really is, at least in the beginning, as was folk percussion, a male-dominated art. But having said that, there are a couple, you know, many people aren't going to know this, but if you look at the four people that I dedicate this book to, they're actually all women. Mostly I did that is because these are four amazing women, but for various reasons that I do that. But the first one says E part, but that's really most people who know me or know who I've studied with, her name is Pak Lin Ha, and she's the only female Samamadhi teacher at the National Center, and she was kind of in the startup group in the late 1980s, and was still one of the only female famous Samamadhi players. Again, an entire dissertation could be written about her and about kind of the role of women in all of this, but again, it was just, for me, it would have taken me away from some of these other things, at least at the time, that I thought were more interesting.
You're mentioning just a little bit earlier your incorporation of an element of the history of, or the genealogy of, this musical practice that you give us such a beautiful account of in the book. And the book really is all about the music, and I really appreciated that as a reader, that we didn't have, you know, a lot of the stuff that you decided not to. I think it was a smart choice. But your invocation of the history as part of this larger story that you're telling really helps underline one of the points that you talk about early in the book. And this is, I think, a really important point. And this is the importance of jettisoning or getting rid of these artificially constructed dichotomies that we typically bring to understanding history and contemporary practice in many, many different ways, old and new, traditional and modern, innovative versus conservative, et cetera, et cetera. And this is, this brings us to a phrase that really frames the book. It frames it, it comes up at least in the way you introduce the beginning and the very end of the book. And this is the phrase, popko changxin. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Preserving the old while creating the new. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of that? Because it is, before we actually get in right into the Nam Sitang and the genealogy, that is a really crucial way of framing the book, both at the beginning and at the end.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to be honest, I can't remember. I don't think I mentioned it in the book either. I don't remember where I discovered that phrase, but while I was thinking about Samamadhi and folk drumming my dissertation and everything, I kept trying to... The framework that I was using, or the lens, was really the cultural asset system, which I don't talk so much about in here. But for listeners or readers who aren't familiar with this, you know, just a 30 second introduction. Essentially, South Korea in the early 1960s started this cultural asset preservation system. It was a law, and it was a system to basically preserve both, you know, tangible and intangible objects of Korean traditional culture. And so this is everything from various aspects of music and dance and other kinds of performative art, but it also had to do with things like Buddhist temples and pottery and things like this. And it was based off a Japanese system, and it's now emulated by UNESCO, and I think there's similar systems in Vietnam as well, but and France. But so for me, that was always the lens that whatever was traditional, it had kind of this original form, and it had a sort of preservationist bent. And I just couldn't, in the beginning anyways, I couldn't align myself with that vision of tradition along with what I was seeing with Samamadhi. And to be honest, in the early years, I kind of looked at Samamadhi as non-traditional as well, not even neo-traditional, just kind of non-traditional. And then, as I say in the book, you know, I started taking lessons later with Samamadhi teachers, and then I discovered this about this itinerant troupe culture, which I guess we'll talk about in a moment, but the idea that there's this whole aspect of Korean history that I wasn't aware of, and I think a number of people aren't aware of, and somewhere in there, I came upon this four Chinese character phrase, and these are kind of like, not necessarily like Zen koans or something, because a lot of them are quite straightforward in the meaning, but there are hundreds and hundreds of these four Chinese character little phrases that have some little, you know, nugget of wisdom in them. And this particular one, popko changxin, preserve the old while creating the new, you know, it has meaning for a whole bunch of reasons, but as soon as I read that or I saw those characters, I thought, this is absolutely what I think about Samamadhi and a lot of other performance arts in Korea, not just, and I think in general about tradition. I started getting much broader with that idea. But so I saw that, but then it still took me time to locate it. And then I ended up finding out that it was by this literary scholar already back in the 1800s who actually is related to another one of the people that I thank in the beginning of this book. This woman, I have it as C. Park. It's actually Park Chanung, who's a Pansori singer who teaches at Ohio State University. It's actually one of her distant relatives who coined that phrase in a particular work. So then all of a sudden, just a whole bunch, and also Chan Park, I mean, she also does modern gigs on Pansori, and she's brought English with Korean singing. That's a whole other conversation. But so she was kind of a guiding light for me as well. And so... With that meaning, I started using that phrase in some earlier writings, and then when I came up to the book as a way of organizing the introduction and conclusion, I thought, this is really fantastic. I mean, for me anyway, and obviously for a Korean a couple hundred years ago, that that's really tradition was always about bringing the current and the contemporary, you know, and there's always kind of a performance element of it as well.
This is very reminiscent of the kinds of conversations that we have in scholarly communities on traditional medicine in East Asia as well. So there's the same kind of discussion about tradition incorporating both the old and the new, and it's really interesting. So let's get to these Namsadang. You're arguing in the book that Samul Nori had its roots in itinerant true performance culture in the 18th and 19th centuries, or the culture of Namsadang, these troop, these people that we've been referencing without talking in detail about it. These are kind of wandering minstrels. And this really constitutes a core argument of the book. So could you introduce the Namsadang for us? Who were they, and what do we need to know about them in order to understand this period of the genealogy of what became Samul Nori?
Yeah, well, for me, what's interesting is that there have been some recent changes, but again, in general, when you read Korean music history books in Korean or English or German or whatever language you're choosing, it tends to focus on upper class culture and like aristocratic culture and court culture. And that's an easy way. It's a path of least resistance, because most of the written documentation in Korea, as it is in other East Asian countries, was written by court, you know, by the elites. And so in the same way, when you look at Western music history, we tend to study the music of, you know, of the palaces and princes and kings, when you think of Beethoven, Mozart, and all of this. And so Korean music history reads in a very similar way, and yet it only is representing, you know, something like 8 or 9% of the music activity of Koreans. And so you know, in the 18th and 19th centuries, there's just a tremendous amount of folk music activity, and a number of genres are being born essentially under the nose of court records, historians, scholars, etc. during that period. And so Namsadang were kind of the extreme opposite end in terms of social hierarchy. So you have court music at one side, and Namsadang would have been the absolute bottom, and according to court dictates, of course. The Namsadang, as you say, were part of a much larger movement of itinerant troops, or kind of wandering minstrel troops, which goes back many hundreds of years in Korea, and there's a lot of overlap with Manchuria and Mongolia and China, with essentially traveling theater troops that were made up of commoner classes, or even kind of you know, within a kind of caste system, I guess, sort of untouchables in a way, as well within Korea. And these were groups of musicians and dancers and actors who traveled up and down Korea, essentially performing or busking for their living. And in a Korean context, there are many different kinds of groups, but most of them shared in common. It was a multi-sided, multi-performance variety show. And so in the case of the Namsadang, it represented not only music and dance, but there was also bull spinning and tightrope walking and mass dance and puppet theater and a number of other acts which they incorporated. And it was all accompanied by music. By the time we get to the sort of late 1800s, these groups had started to sort of solidify in terms of what the performance arts were. And they also started to, for example, you'd have performance troops that were all men or all women. You didn't tend to have a lot of mixing between them because of various sort of social stigma associated with that, particularly unmarried men and unmarried women traveling together. And the Namsadang were, until quite recently, were all male performance troops that had specific connections with fundraising and also with Buddhist temples. And so literally Namsadang just means sort of male Buddhist temple performance group. And so these were groups that were, importantly, they were professionally based, and they were constantly evolving. I guess for me, that what was important setting up this book for a context for Samul Nori was that the Namsadang's take on tradition was always something that changed. It was day to day, it was village to village, and for them to survive, it was constantly updating and revising, and it included things like including virtuosity, right? Like the more impressive your tightrope walking was, like if you could do flips and jumps and stuff, you were better than the next Namsadang group. And if your drummers could spin their hats faster and the guys could jump higher in the air and you could throw more bowls at one time, you know, et cetera, et cetera, that meant that your group was going to excel. And so it was just a very different view of also what folk culture meant, because I think even my background in the West, folk culture always meant kind of an unprofessional, kind of raw, simple, you know, sort of within quotation marks, you know, kind of authentic or something. And the Nam Sadang for me completely challenged or erased that kind of idea that you couldn't have virtuosity and change and kind of updating to culture and still be completely traditional. So that's why I lead the book off with them. And that's for me, I mean, now there are Korean music histories that are beginning to include them. And I think that's a really crucial point to Korean music history.
Great, thank you. And in the capsule history that you're giving of Nam Sadang in this first chapter, you show us, or you take us through a period of what you call decline and dormancy between 1900 and 1960, that prefaces a revival from 1960 to the present in the culture of Nam Sadang and the kind of re-envisioning of Nam Sadang within a modern Korean society. Can you talk a little bit about that later revival in the 1960s of Nam Sadang? Because that will ultimately lead us into the eventual emergence of Samul Nordy in the 1970s.
Yeah, so, you know, the 1960s, as I talked about a little while ago, Korea is just coming off of course, the World War II and also Civil War, the Korean War. And so the 60s, you've got North and South separated, and somewhat of stability there. But of course, both countries are still staggering from the two previous wars. And so in South Korea, as I said, I think it's 1962, they start this cultural asset or cultural properties preservation law in order to basically start recovering tradition, which was lost, particularly during the war. I mean, we're talking... Well, and also you have the Japanese annexation, of course, in 1910. So we're looking at a good 50-year or more period in which a lot of the traditional arts went underground or almost were destroyed. And this is true of the Nam Sadang. The Nam Sadang, where the activity was banned by the Japanese already, I think, by 1914 or 13 or something. And so, you know, the Nam Sadang go underground or they kind of disappear. And then as you get into the 50s and 60s, the Korean government is trying to revive, particularly folk cultures. I mean, you had court culture and things like this, but a lot of that was already notated or documented, so there wasn't the same sense of anxiety as there was with folk music. And so the Nam Sadang are one of the early targets. I say targets, one of the early groups that are targeted to try to find people, the Nam Sadang, in the countryside to try to revive or at least in some sense of oral history or maybe some of the music down, some recording, something. And the problem, of course, is that many of the older Nam Sadang had died during this 50-year interim. And the few Nam Sadang or children of Nam Sadang who survived, the vast majority of them, they wanted to escape their past. I mean, they, for as much as they loved the art that they were doing, they wanted to escape the social stigma, particularly for their children. So most of them never came out or never admitted to anyone, even to this day, that they were a part of the Nam Sadang culture. And many of them moved to Seoul and changed their names and changed professions and essentially tried to get their children, you know, educated into college and away from this past. And so, What ends up happening is that the government is able to find a few quite elderly Nam Sadang who they begin to collect together, and those who can perform, they begin to form this kind of makeshift Nam Sadang troupe in and around Seoul. And this begins to happen mid-late 1960s. And so that's the first sort of bit where Nam Sadang begins to sort of be reborn. And central to this, I'll just mention one fellow's name, but there's this Professor Shim Woo-sung who... very young scholar at the time. He's now extremely famous, well-known, but at the time, almost single-handedly, one of the researchers who literally went out into the countryside, found old Nam Sadang. Some of them, you know, barely had enough money to eat or to go anywhere. He even invited many of them to his home, kind of in the area around Seoul, and fed many of them and actually took care of some of them for a number of years and really got this Nam Sadang troupe going. So that was the revival, the early bits of revival, the late 60s and 70s, when the Nam Sadang were designated as one of these intangible cultural assets. But the context for Samul Nordy grows out of this. Essentially, you had the older Nam Sadang then started looking for younger players to teach this tradition. So we've got a break in the tradition. I mean, in terms of the lineage, you've got a number of years where there's no direct lineage except for a few of these old fellows. We begin to teach to, you know, primarily men, a few women, but primarily men in their late teens, early 20s. And Kim Deok-soo is one of these, one of the founders of Samul Nordy, and this other fellow, Kim Yong-bae. These are two extremely important names, but these are two of these younger generation guys, 16, 17, 18-year-olds, who have contacts with this cultural asset Nam Sadang team. And in fact, Kim Yong-bae actually joined the team for a while, but Kim Deok-soo was doing other things. But and I think what happened when we read back on their reflections on the late 60s, early 70s, is that they were excited about the Nam Sadang coming back. They thought, oh, maybe there's going to be a revival. Maybe Korean society will embrace them again. But it doesn't happen. And there's sort of infighting, and there's other aspects of trying to figure out what's going to happen with the Nam Sadang, because now that they're a cultural asset, they're not allowed to change their performance art. They're not allowed to update, you know, their thing, which was such a core part of what they did for hundreds and hundreds of years. And so really what happens, what Samul Nodi is born out of, is younger generation men at the time who said, you know, this isn't acceptable for us anyways. We have to be able to update this tradition. We have to be able to consider the concert hall stage. We have to consider maybe changing the instrumentation. We have to talk about fusion and amplification and all these other things that, if Nam Sadang had continued to exist throughout time, probably would have embraced on their own. And so that's really the context for the first chapter and why it's important to understand that. And the Samul Nodi is really, they were all official. I mean, somewhere in their background, they're officially called Nam Sadang, you know, back in their teens and early 20s, but then broke away from the cultural asset team to form their own genre, their own vision of it. So that's why, for me, I think, in my interpretation, and most, I think most Koreans as well, it's an outgrowth of the Nam Sadang.
Thank you. Now, early in the book and early in the chapter before we move on, you introduce three notions that not only help us understand the history of the Nam Sadang and sort of the history of the Nam Sadang in this broader context, but also link up the story that you're telling with a larger historiography in many fields. And these are notions that I'll just mention, but I won't ask you to talk about at this point, of cosmopolitanism, nationalism, and globalization. And you've already mentioned a little bit about the interactions of Nam Sadang with China and with Mongolia, which sort of gets at a kind of early history of these globalizing forces. But there's another theme that also comes up that's really central to a lot of what you're doing in the book, and that is also right now being thematized as a central concern for understanding a whole bunch of humanistic fields, from the early modern world to the history of science and medicine to the circulation of images, objects, people, and ideas more broadly. And that is the theme of itinerancy. So itinerancy and movement. So in the course of the book, you really seem to be urging us to understand Samul Nodi in this wider context of the importance of thinking about kind of transformative and generative force and aspects of itinerancy and movement. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that as it shapes the way you think about this work.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, thank you for picking up on that, because really, in terms of the title, like a lot of people who work with books, we have all these really kind of interesting titles that are usually shot down by the publishers. Because they get maybe too far away. And I really wanted to have Motion or On the Road or some kind of, it works its way into chapter titles, but I couldn't really get it into although I got Itinerant Performance Culture into the subtitle. But so that itinerancy, I love that feeling or the movement. I tried to organize all the chapters around it. I liked it literally to begin with, because the Nam Sadang were literally on the road all the time. I'm constantly moving. And what I liked about Samul Nodi is there's a very literal aspect to their travels as well. Not only throughout Korea, but very early on, they begin to travel. I mean, literally, they not only all over South Korea, but they very early on in their establishing the genre in the early 80s. You know, they go to Japan, and then they go to the U.S., and they go to Europe. It's this constant, which is true of many musicians, as you say, all over many cultures. I mean, itinerant groups is almost a kind of a definition of what it means to be a musician in most parts of the world. And Samul Nodi is always on the road too. And they kept using that image or metaphor themselves. I mean, I mentioned that in one of the chapters. I mean, so many CDs are called On the Road or From the Road or The Road or, you know, so even in their own minds, and the cover as well, which hopefully we can talk about the cover at some point. There's this beautiful shot of a road, you know, and so without beating, you know, readers' heads, you know, over their heads with this image or idea. So there's a little literal part of itinerancy that I love. But as you say, too, for me, it also had to do with kind of the idea of evolution and for culture or aspects of tradition to kind of stay relevant or pertinent is that, yes, it has to keep moving. You know, and I think for Samul Nodi, it had to do with not just with there was movement in terms of developing of their pieces. And not only the selection of pieces, but, you know, they constantly revised and updated the pieces that they settled on relatively early. And, you know, from there they started thinking, how can we work with world musicians, you know, and non-Korean musicians? And eventually they would settle on jazz musicians, which I talk about in chapter five. But, you know, they would to African musicians and South American musicians and Southeast Asian musicians and traditions. And so there was that aspect. And then there's also the idea that they had to think about their pedagogy. They had to keep revising, and that had audiences who weren't going to be able to speak Korean. And also a lot of what they were doing or teaching hadn't been written down. It was an oral tradition. So there's all this effort, which essentially is chapter four, which is talking about all of their pedagogical materials. And so I don't know, it just felt like they were just constantly had to keep thinking of ways to not just modify it, but sort of explain or identify, and I think to themselves as much as it was to their audiences and to their students, what was important about Salmoni, what people should know about it. And so, yeah, as you say, I mean, for me, particularly in ethnomusicology as well, but I think you're absolutely right about history and sociology and a lot of the other humanities-based fields, that it's kind of organic and moving and transforming idea of culture, and then it's also very it's very human based. I mean, culture is really it's enacted by people. That sounds like a really silly or overly obvious thing to say, but you know, it's easy sometimes if you read a lot of heavy theory to start talking about institutions making movement or governments making movement, things like this, where in almost all cases we're really talking about a small group of individuals who are working together or against each other or whatever. And I think particularly with Salmono, that was also part of the idea, was that essentially you have a group of about four musicians and about another four or five people who almost single-handedly got this entire kind of movement going.
Thank you. Now, as we move further into the book, we have a chapter two, that looks really closely at the rise of urban culture in South Korea in the 1970s. And it focuses in particular here on Seoul. Now, here we see the transformations in the folk musical culture are really situated within broader debates about how the arts and various performative arts might serve the kind of emergence of new meanings of Korean identity in this period. Now, this chapter pays special attention to something that will also be really important in the next chapter, which are new urban spaces of performance, new urban spaces where music is not just performed and sort of enacted, but really re-envisioned for a very different kind of environment. So you talk about in here the importance of concert halls as really massive spaces, and you focus in on the importance of two in particular, one, the National Center for Korean Traditional Performing Arts, and also the Space Theater. Can you talk a little bit about the Space Theater in this context and the ways that the Space Theater really, in many ways, lays the foundation for the emergence of what becomes Samonori?
Yeah, so I was saying in the 1970s, there's one South Korea, there's a little bit of, a little bit of economic stability and political stability, and militarily wise too, there's not necessarily as much concern. There's still concern, but about North Korea. And so with a little bit more money, a little bit more time, and as things are leveling off in South Korea, of course, there's a chance then for many Koreans, particularly academics and those at the governmental level, to think about really what it means to be Korean. And especially as the world is starting, this is at the front end of people beginning to talk about sort of intercultural interactions, which of course have happened a lot, but in a much more accelerated rate, of course, in the 1970s and later. And what does it really mean to be Korean? And so this is a part of the discourse in South Korea everywhere about what does it mean to be Korean? And does it mean, to distill all of this discussion down, does it mean to go back to looking at how Koreans, acted and dressed and ate and listened, in the 1800s or the early 1900s? Or does it mean, because in the 1970s already many Koreans are quite savvy in terms of Western classical music and dress and poetry and theater and modern dance. And for many of them, for many Koreans at that time, being Korean meant somehow incorporating modernity, at the same time. And this is, of course, true of so many countries in the 60s, 70s, and even 80s. And so this is kind of in the air in the 1970s. And you have all these different approaches to what it means in terms of kind of proportion, I guess, a ratio to how much of the West or the new or the modern or cosmopolitan is going to be overlaid or is going to accompany these older ways of kind of viewing the world, older Korean ways of viewing the world. So as you mentioned, this particular theater, it's called the Kongan Sarang in Korean. It just means love of space, which is a beautiful name. But in English, it's often just called the Space Theater. And this was essentially a space group. To back up just a little bit, the Space Group was a group of architects and writers and folklorists who started a society and a newsletter, which eventually became a magazine just called Space Kongan. And it was a group of like-minded individuals who were, in terms of proportion, were very much keyed into older traditional, you know, folkways in particular, not so much courtways, but folkways, but who also felt that there had to be new, there had to be movement, there had, and these are all words that they use, and there had to be evolution, a respect of the past, but some kind of respectful evolution for being a modern Korean. And part of their, this new vision of theirs was to create this concert hall called the Kongan Sarang, which is the concert hall wing of this whole larger group. And they built this concert hall in a very different way from all the other concert halls, being most of the other concert halls being built in the 1970s, which were these massive 4,000, 5,000 seat theaters, essentially for Western orchestras and opera productions and huge modern dance productions accompanied by orchestra. And so Kongan Sarang, in contrast, I don't have the number of seats here. It's somewhere, I think it's only a couple hundred, but essentially it built it as a small little room to mimic essentially sort of the meeting or greeting room of the aristocrat of yesteryear. So a very small, intimate space, essentially to have acoustic, small ensemble, traditionally based performances. And in the beginning, they essentially programmed folk music or aristocratic folk music genres, which were, you know, very small in conception. And they also did a few things with maybe one or two dancers with music and some vocal music concerts as well. And that was the community. This already came about a number of years, already early 70s. There's a community of people going to these small concerts and thinking of ways of, more intimate ways of envisioning Korean traditional music. And that's exactly as you say, that's really, I think Samul Nori was also given an idea through that. You know, if the Kongan Sarang had never been built, I mean, you know, we could guess forever. If that small theater had never been built and that society hadn't grouped, it's hard to say if Samul Nori would have come about, or it might have taken them longer, or maybe they would have initially started it as a much larger group trying to match those huge concert hall stages. So I think you're absolutely right. That small, intimate stage had a tremendous amount to do with Samul Nori coming about.
Now, as we move further into the book, you give us a really detailed and I think really, really wonderful account here of the texture of one of the sort of rhythmic entities that lead us into understanding that really the music itself. But we get there in this chapter 3, On the Road, by looking first at the ways that Samul Nori really adapted their style to urban concert hall stages. You've already talked a little bit about some of the transformations that were involved there, transformations from to an inside context, transformations in terms of relationships between musicians and their audience. You also talk here about the importance of a kind of commodification of music and the thinking of music in different kinds of units. So could you speak a little bit to that kind or that aspect of the kinds of transformations that were necessary in this part of the book for adaptation to this very different kind of musical context?
Yeah, so because within, well, not just musicology and ethnomusicology, but the idea of, you know, the same piece or the so-called same piece, you know, being envisioned in different contexts, everything from a live context to hearing it live on a radio broadcast, you know, to being recorded, to et cetera, et cetera. These kinds of issues have all happened with Samul Nori. And for me, I thought the easiest way, at least for this chapter, for the book, for readers and others to wrap their brains around this, was to pick same piece, or at least, as you say, the same rhythm of which pieces were constructed around, and then to look at the same piece as it goes through these kinds of various stages on their way to sort of this, for lack of a better term, kind of a total commodification, you know, of the project. So that's the way that the chapter is organized. And just to be very brief about it, in the first part of the chapter, I essentially talk about the original context, which is this piece as played by the rural folk percussion troops in the countryside. And I distinguish there a little bit. I mean, the Nam Sadang also played this piece, so their version of it would have been a little slicker, a little more impressive, but nonetheless, it would have been outside with a large group, and it would have been for, you know, countryside village people. And so this is the original context of this piece that I look at in the chapter, and it's a piece that's been around a couple hundred years, and it's a very well-known piece. And from there, the next stage then is Samul Nori taking this piece and turning essentially what is about an hour and a half performance, out, boiling it down, taking out sort of the most distinctive rhythms or aspects of it and boiling it down into this kind of eight and a half minute piece to play on a concert hall stage. And for me, that's the second stage in this sort of the evolution or the journey for this particular piece. And so it's still a live piece. It isn't commodified per se, but it is now being played on a concert hall stage. And where in the past, the concert in the countryside, it would have been free, and basically anyone who was there could have shown up. Now you do have this element of monetary exchange, which leads to commodification, of course. But to see a Samuel Nodi concert, of course, at least in these concert halls, you have to pay a lot of money, usually not a lot, but you still pay money to go see the concert. And it's now being presented on stage, and it has a little bit different meaning. Although in the book, I try to say that for many people coming to see Samuel Nodi, for them, it's still a participatory thing. But the concert hall stage sort of works against that in a few ways. So that's sort of the second stage I talk about. And then the third one is when this piece then becomes recorded, the Samuel Nodi version becomes recorded. And the recording I focus on, again, for people who know the countryside and the Samuel Nodi version, of course they recognize the piece, but now they can listen to the piece at, you know, like most CDs, or now MP3 files. You can listen to it at any time of day, generally out of context, and there's a little sense of distance there. And I think when non-Koreans, or Koreans who don't know this tradition, of which there are many, when they hear the CD, it's still the liner notes and everything set it up as a traditional performance, which I think it is, but again, now it's as a disc, and you don't see the live performers anymore. So now it has become commodified, both in terms of as an object that you can exchange and you pay for it, but it's completely divorced from the original, at least time-wise, and spatially it's divorced. And then the final version I show is when the same piece on CD is now joined up as a fusion work, as a hybrid work, which I discussed in more detail in the last chapter. But now you've got a piece that is now accompaniment to a Western kind of modern or avant-garde jazz setting. And so now even same audiences may not recognize the Korean percussion or that piece anymore. Even though it's the same piece, it's the same rhythms being played nearly identical in all four contexts. Now it's part of a CD that has English and it's being circulated on a world, you know, global music or world pop music stage. And of course it's a commodity, but it's even that much more distance. It's being sold outside of Korea. Some of these recordings don't have any Korean liner notes at all, and you could even come away from the recording knowing very little or nothing about the countryside tradition. So that was really the trajectory that I tried to accomplish with that chapter.
Now, this is really fascinating on a number of different levels, and I won't dwell too much on this because I want to make sure that we get to the other chapters as well. But I just want to mention for listeners, because not only is this Rikken, someone who is interested in translation studies, read this as a kind of story about translation of a particular kind of rhythmic unit or rhythmic cycle into different contexts, but also just from the perspective of someone interested in modes of argument and modes of close reading, you give us a really wonderful close reading of a musical narrative in here that really simultaneously engages a reader's attention to the story that you're telling, to this special form of musical notation, so Korean box notation, and at the same time, and really simultaneously, to the songs included on the CD that accompanies the book. And so it's a really, in this chapter, I just want to make sure that I don't let you go without at least mentioning this. It's a really wonderful model of what close reading of music in context can look like. And it was, I think, really inspiring for me in this context.
Well, thank you, because to be honest, it was one of the chapters that was rewritten the most. And specifically because I've done much more detailed analysis with a lot of notation. And in earlier stages of the book, I actually was kind of ping-ponging back and forth between having a one whole chapter of a lot of notation, very dense theoretical discussion, and the editors of the book really felt it was inappropriate for the way that I'd written the other chapters, and that it was good for me to rethink it, and also even the notation, coming up with this hybrid notation, and to try to think of simple, clear, but somewhat detailed way of getting through it. And so, I haven't really had a chance to talk to a lot of basically non-Korean drummers about this text. So I'm actually quite happy that you're very kind in saying that, because this was really the chapter that went through a lot of revisions and I had a lot of different people read it to try to get some kind of balance there. So anyways, thank you very much for those comments.
Oh, my pleasure. And I'll just say, I think it really works. I think the amount of notation in the chapter is perfect. If you didn't have that kind of notation, it would be a very different experience, right, for the reader of trying to put all these different elements of the story together. And also in this section, you talk very explicitly about the analogy of the road, which we've talked a little bit about before. Okay, so you also have a chapter here that's really, really interesting that looks at the pedagogical materials and the pedagogical settings, of Samuel Nordi and its training of musicians. Can you speak a little bit to the nature of what's happening in this chapter? So you're describing something that's actually really, really interesting and really surprising, which is the ways that Samuel Nordi integrated musical and cosmological theory into their pedagogical materials in this really interesting way. So can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, well, the way that I came into the pedagogical materials is that the original Samuel Nordi group, already in the 80s and early 90s, came out with these workbooks that were both in Korean and English. And they became kind of, for lack of better terms, sort of Bibles within the Samuel Nordi world. Not only did they have notation for the pieces, but it actually gave a little bit of background history and even philosophy, which those of us, or for people who hadn't met the original members or didn't have the opportunity to travel to Korea, they were able to read some of the background thinking or philosophy of all of this. So I got my hands on these books very early, in fact, when they first came out, again, kind of on the sly because I was doing all this research on the folk drumming, but I was collecting all these books, but they kept referencing these sort of cosmological principles, and the one had to do in Korean, there's a Korean term for it, but in English it's translated circle, square, triangle. And they melted or melded all of these different ways of thinking about rhythm and movement and even rhythmic structure and analysis to this kind of core principle. They also brought in yin and yang or um and yang, which most of us know, but it was everything linked back to the circle, square, and triangle, but they didn't really say where that came from. So I mean, I have to say it was about 3 years of digging around, again on the side, trying to figure out what was the meaning of these three symbols and what were they linked to. And so that's really what this chapter fleshes out in the beginning parts, is that these are very old Chinese ritual, cosmological principles, essentially the idea of the circle as encompassing the heavens, and the square represents the earth, and the triangle represents humankind. And it's this kind of, there's a threeness, and there are all these this numerology and other things coming together. But what for me was really interesting is that, unlike other pedagogical books in Korean traditional music world or Western music world, Samuel Nordi was using this really old cosmological principles to base their teaching methodology on, which was sort of counterintuitive at the time, I think, in the late 80s and 90s, where all these other books were becoming very Western, and a lot of them were based off of German models and models in the West that things like Kodai and Orff and all of these sort of music pedagogical models. And Samuel Nordi was completely sidestepping all of this. And they were going back to this more than 1,000-year-old ideas about the cosmos and humans and rhythm and culture. And then they really ingeniously were able to map all, for me, very successful. I think there might be some Koreans who felt it might be a little forced, but for me, very successful way of mapping these ideas of heaven, earth, and humans, and the numerology that was assigned with it, and also the imagery of circles and squares in particular, into everything, into notation, into their dance, the ways of thinking about dance, the way of teaching breath, and even down to the musical analysis. I really only scraped the surface in this chapter. There's some really detailed Korean master's theses and dissertations that go into even more detail about how these cosmological principles work themselves out all the way down to the minutest level of rhythm and costuming and ground formations and all of this. So for me, that chapter is not only for me, but actually, to be honest, for a number of Koreans and non-Koreans to actually explain what the meaning of those symbols were and how it worked its way into Korean pedagogy. And for me, because I have a lot of friends in music education and also music therapy that have looked at some of these things and have found that it's a really interesting way to introduce this culture as well.
And this really gets at also three major themes that are emerging in lots of the chapters in the book, right? The importance that we talk of what we talked about just before, which is this kind of way of translating something, some core thing across and within very different kinds of contexts, the importance of popko changshin, right, preserving the old while creating the new, and it also is a way of thinking about another element of the importance of movement in space that we've been talking about. It's really interesting. So, okay, chapter 5. Chapter 5 gets us into a super, super fascinating part of the story, and I am absolutely not going to let you get off the Skype until we talk about this, because this is a fascinating chapter. Okay, so Chapter 5 looks closely at the really, really fascinating story of the collaboration between Samuel Nori and the Euro-American jazz quartet Red Sun. So the title of this is East-West Encounters in the Nanjang. So first, to take a term from this title, what is a Nanjang, and what significance does it have for the story that you're telling in this chapter?
Well, the Nanjang were these really kind of pre-20th century events, although they've been revived in the last few years, but Nanjang were these huge kind of village festivals, for lack of a better word, that essentially they were allowed by the village elders as a way for sort of the local, the working classes, essentially, to be able to blow off some steam. It included things like wrestling matches and gambling, and it was also huge sort of periodic markets. We had all these people coming in from various places, sometimes outside of Korea, selling various wares. And so it's this big kind of party, festival, circus atmosphere that would happen anywhere for a day to a few days. And within the Nanjang, for the villages that could afford it, they would often bring in, which is kind of going back in a theme through the book, if they could, they would bring in these itinerant troops to perform, often as the highlight of a particular festival. And if you could bring in a Namsadang troupe, that was really one of the best ways to kind of cap off a day or a number of days in which all of these other, you know, sort of fun and craziness was going on. And so that's why I talk about Nanjang. It's also an important word. It's not, of course, I didn't make it up or even make the initial connection. The original Samuel Nori group felt that the word Nanjang was important and the connection to Namsadang. So they named their first recording studio after Nanjang, and they named a CD after Nanjang. And they also had a coffee club, which unfortunately closed a few years ago, but that was a great place to hang out as well. It was also called the Nanjang Club. So it's a connection that Samuel Nori also made to make that kind of, a key point is that the Nanjang was a place where for Korean countryside people would often see kind of foreign culture. So not just the Namsadang, but also traveling merchants and even performers from China and other places. So the Nanjang was also a meeting space for foreign culture.
Great. And this element of foreign culture really gets at the importance that you're raising here of hybridity and syncretism as a powerful tool for cross-cultural bridging and understanding, and also as an important sort of phenomenon to keep in mind as we look at what's happening in this part of the history of Samuel Nori and in the history of Korean music, perhaps more generally. So you take us through this story that involves the sort of founding of Korea's first rock band in the 60s, into a story about jazz music in Korea. Now, you mentioned that Korean folk percussion and jazz actually share some structural traits, including a kind of cyclical framework, an importance of rhythm, improvisation, the kind of importance of balance and contrast between leather and metal for material culture fans who might be listening. This all comes to a really wonderful conclusion in this chapter with the story about the collaboration and the ongoing collaboration over several CDs and several meetings between Samuel Nori and Red Sun. So can you talk for us a little bit about Red Sun? Who were they? Who are they? And how did they develop a relationship with Samuel Nori?
Yeah, well, Red Sun, to make a relatively long story brief, what happened is Samuel Nori, as we were saying earlier, they were touring almost from the very beginning. And one of their favorite places to go was Europe, particularly Germany and Austria, for various reasons. They found a huge and willing fan base there. Same was true of Japan. These are kind of early places that Samuel Nori traveled to quite regularly. And Samuel Nori was invited as part of this huge ethnic percussion, festival that was taking place in Austria. And during this time, Samuel Nori met this saxophonist and flute player named Wolfgang Puschnigg, who very famous in the new music scene and the kind of avant-garde jazz scene in Europe, particularly Western Europe. And they kind of struck up a friendship, and so much so that they essentially invited Puschnigg to come back to Korea to do some concerts with them. And that was the beginning. I don't think they realized how far this collaboration was going to go, but that was the initial contact point, was this one jazz musician who was very well-known in Austria and Germany, collaborating with Samuel Nori as an individual. And from there, they began to think, well, why don't we try to get a kind of a complement group, sort of a Western jazz quartet to match the original Zamamori quartet. So this is really where the idea of Red Sun was born. And so Kuschnigg on the Austrian European jazz side essentially got together a vocalist who was his partner at the time, and then also brought in initially a pianist that later became a guitarist, and also a bass player, two musicians from the U.S. that he had collaborated with. So really, Red Sun was only formed at the beginning as a counterpart, a direct counterpart to Zamamori, for the idea of doing collaborations. I don't think in the beginning they had planned on doing such an ambitious collaboration, although I talk about this in the book. Initially, it was really just about putting one CD out together, but more importantly, doing a number of concerts that they would do both in Europe and in Korea, and also Japan. And so that was the beginning of this kind of relationship between Red Sun and Zamamori. And then, as I outline in this chapter, over time, they became more and more interested in each other's music. I mean, Red Sun started learning Korean drumming. A number of the Zamamori guys started learning Western harmony, and they see pictures of them holding guitars and, you know, Casio keyboards and stuff like that, trying to figure out each other's music and listening to each other's music. Zamamori listening to Western jazz, avant-garde jazz, different ways of improvising. And then the Western jazz musicians listening to Korean vocal music and studying Korean music theory, for example, and learning these really complex, amazing rhythms, which, you know, I talk about a little bit in chapter 3. And so by the end of the chapter, I really talk about what ends up becoming this nearly decade-long interaction, which results in 4 CDs, but also hundreds of workshops and concerts and spin-off CDs from that project. So that's how the two came together.
And listeners who may not know this, if you buy the book, you also get a CD that includes 3 of the recordings by this collaboration of Red Sun and Zamamori that you talk about in this chapter. Now, in addition to talking in this chapter about this this changing nature of their collaboration that we can chart over the course of their concerts together and their recordings, you end with, or pretty close to the end, you mention one of your own performances in 2008 at UBC. That's actually, it's available on YouTube, and I went and I listened to it before we talked, and it's fantastic. So can you talk a little bit about that? What was the nature of your own work in bringing together these different musical registers, and can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, and I think we're talking about the fusion piece, yes?
The fusion piece, yeah, in 2008.
Mm-hmm. It's just called, I'm not very creative with titles, and also I'm not much of a composer, so it's called Samul Rock Fusion, Samulian rock music, and the instrumentation is the traditional Korean percussion quartet, 2 drums and 2 gongs, but also included a large Javanese gong, because we have large gamelan program here, but also I happen to love the sound and the size of the gong, and then also an electric bass and electric guitar. And so, and this was a project that grew out of essentially a number of graduate students we had in the program at the time who were already doing their own fusion projects that were envisioning Balinese gamelan for a rock group and other people doing Javanese music for bluegrass ensemble. And so there was all this other and kind of amazing craziness going on at school. And the funny thing is that there's a set of Korean rhythms that, for whatever reasons, when I was learning them a number of years ago, in my head, I could always sing out electric bass and electric guitar part. And this will probably come up at the end of the interview in terms of future research directions. But I listened to a lot of rock music. And for whatever reason, there were about 3 Korean rhythms in particular that always triggered this kind of bass line and also a kind of melodic line with electric guitar. So I'd already, for fun, started sketching down this information. And as I said, I've never composed before this. And so when I saw that a number of students were beginning to organize this fusion concert, I thought I'd push myself to continue in this vein. So that was the genesis for that. But it also felt right in a way, because I had a number of Zamamori teachers by this point, by mid-2000s, who were saying, "Oh, Nathan, you should, you know a lot of the Zamamori pieces fairly well, and, you know, there aren't a lot of fusion pieces except for this Red Sun stuff." And, 2008, Red Sun had already disbanded, and they weren't really working with Zamamori so much. And so they said, "Why don't you try doing your own fusion piece?" So whether or not, you know, listeners enjoy it or not is a whole separate issue. But for me, it was really fun to try to put together rhythms and that instrumentation. And since that time, we've actually performed it about 5 times. But as you said, I think that very first performance is up on YouTube.
Yes, it's wonderful. And I urge listeners to go there. And in the book, you actually give the web address for the YouTube video. So it's great. Well, Nathan, we've taken up a whole lot of your time. I'll just mention for listeners right before we wrap up with our final questions that there is this wonderful conclusion that really takes this story and brings it into your thoughts about the future of Korean traditional music and which groups might be embodying that. We revisit the theme here of this Pukgo Changshin. And you consider throughout the book, but really in this conclusion very directly, the nature of one of the things that came up at the very beginning of our conversation, this cultural asset system of the Korean government and its significance for the future of musical performance in Korea. So there's lots more in the book that we didn't actually have a chance to talk about, but that I just want to gesture at for listeners who I hope will be looking at the book if they haven't already after this conversation. So Nathan, now that there's obviously a ton of material in the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about, now that we're at the end, is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about but that you want to mention for the sake of listeners? And in addition to, and I know one of those things is going to be the cover because you already talked about that. So do you want to say a little bit about the cover, and is there anything else that you'd like to mention for listeners?
Yeah, well, before the cover, and on a less serious note, I think what's interesting, when I was in conversations with my doctoral supervisor, who I'm still in touch with quite a bit, and who's written quite a bit about the cultural asset system, he felt after he had gone through Samulnori with me, I mean, once it was published, he had seen earlier versions, of course, but with the final product, he felt that it seemed like I'd been a little bit unfair or critical of the cultural asset system, which in the conclusion I am. But I think if I can clarify it all, because of course with the book, you know, once it's set in print, it's hard to change what's there unless you add a postlude or something, you know, down the road. I think if there's any clarification there, it's that for me, because I read about this in my first book on folk drumming, the cultural asset system, I think absolutely was central to saving a lot of Korean traditional culture. I mean, I want to be clear about that in this book as well, that I feel that if that system hadn't been there, its warts and conflicts and challenges and everything, you know, notwithstanding, that if that system hadn't been in place, I just think Korea would have lost a tremendous amount of their performative culture in particular. And so what I'm critical about in the back of this book is that I feel that the cultural asset system, in my opinion, doesn't work particularly well for those folk traditions that were always based on movement and generation and improvisation in particular. So I think there's some folk traditions that work really well with the cultural asset system. But I think Namsadong was a group that maybe never should have been designated, only because the cultural asset system, once you're documented, you have to play the way this document, whenever that document in that chosen or frozen, you know, moment in time and space, you can't evolve or move away from that particular version. And I think that's just antithetical to what the Namsadong stand for. So for me, I felt the asset system doesn't work particularly well for a group like the Namsadong. But it's not that it doesn't work well, really, really well for court and aristocratic, you know, genres, and even a fair number of kind of sort of, for lack of a better term, aristocratic folk genres. I just think with Namsadong and some of the more shaman-based musics as well, improvisatory-based musics, that cultural asset system doesn't, maybe shouldn't have been used with these. And I think particularly now as we look into the you know, 21st century, I don't know that, I feel like the cultural asset system is holding back a couple of these genres, for example, like Namsadong. And I know we don't have much time to discuss this, but that was something I talked about briefly in the book and many conversations I've had with my Namsadong teachers, that it's a kind of frustration that they feel as well. Mm-hmm. So that's in terms of a little more serious. On a lighter note, you know, the covers for books, it's kind of a funny thing for people if they haven't published an academic book or haven't worked with it. Often, you know, with earlier books or with some publishers, often the author has no choice, you know, in the cover art. And I think that's changing a little bit. But with this particular book, this was the cover that I always wanted. This is a book, because obviously listeners can't see it. This is a cover that was taken in the 1980s, and it was by a very famous Japanese photographer who was touring with Samulnori kind of at the height of their popularity. And he took some of these really amazing shots of the group. And the one that's here, to describe it briefly, it's Kim Deok-soo. It's not me. People ask me if this was me. It's not me. Kim Deok-soo, one of the original founders of the group, is a back shot from him. And he's wearing an outfit, which in this context could be a Samulnori outfit. It could be a Namsadong outfit. It could be any one of these outfits. And he's walking down this road And the picture actually extends over onto the back cover, so you have to open up the whole thing to see it. But it's like walking between these mountain ranges and the sense of distance and travel. And it's a little bit lonely feeling. I didn't really mean for the book to be nostalgic necessarily, although I think a lot of the quotes I use are nostalgic. But this cover I'd wanted, and again, I'm making this longer than it needs to be, but it was very difficult to get the permissions for this because it was difficult to find the photographer who has passed away, and it was difficult to find who had permissions and who would have the rights and how we could get it. And this was about a 9-month project, actually trying to get this cover. And in fact, it went away. There was going to be a different cover up until very, very close to publication deadline. And then we were able to locate the permissions for this cover. And it also matches one of their classic CDs from the late 1980s. And there's just a whole bunch of reasons that I wanted this. So it's kind of a funny thing maybe to end this on, but I'm really happy with the cover.
And also people who go to the site for this interview will be able to see a picture of the cover. So.
Okay, great.
Beautiful cover. So, Nathan, I know we don't have much time. I know you probably have to run, but what's next for you? Now that the book is out, and congratulations on the book, as I've said, it's wonderful. What is currently inspiring you right now?
It will seem like, to be brief, it will seem like a complete sort of 180-degree turn in research direction. The last year and a half, I've been working on a new research area, which is it's still based on rhythm, but otherwise no connection to Korea. And I've been looking at rhythmic ambiguity, particularly at the beginnings of songs in British rock music.
Mm.
So, and the thing that links the two, I think, has to do with rhythm. If I come up with a semi-fancy way of connecting the two, I would say it has to do with rhythm and social meaning. So for me, it's as I start working my way now into British rock, but particularly the use of rhythm by particular bands and particular composers. It's also it's a kind of communication happening through a rhythmic lens that I'm interested in. And so I guess that's a way of linking it to all the ways that I've tried to link, you know, broader ideas or subjects to rhythm through the lens of Korean, you know, folk percussion. And so, but this is music that I've, again, just to finish up, this is music that really I grew up with, having older brothers in a basement listening to this music, but it's not exactly, I'm not quite that old, but a lot of bands that I'm looking at in the 60s, 70s, and 80s do really, really interesting things rhythmically. And so for me, it's kind of doing field work at home, or it's kind of coming back to a music that I know really well. And it's also a little bit of a slight political move on my side as well, because I think within the broader field of ethnomusicology, there's kind of this challenging of this idea that we always have to study the other, or we always have to go really far away, you know, just to first study, you know, for research objects or people that we work with. And even though East Asia actually feels quite close to me, having, you know, grown up in Japan and spending all this time in East Asia, it's still, in a sense, nice for me to, in a way, come back to music that I grew up with and that I have, you know, a very different kind of relationship with. So that's, I think that's going to occupy me now for some time. And actually my first article on this will come out 2 weeks from now, and it will be on Radiohead. So for listeners who are interested in rhythmic ambiguity in the music of radio, it's a journal called Music Theory Online, and you can access it for free from anywhere. So they just punch in Nathan Hesselink and Music Theory Online, in about 3 weeks they'll be able to read it.
Perfect. And I'll try to include a link to that on the post as well. Well, thank you, Nathan. This has been wonderful. The new project sounds fantastic too, and congratulations again. It's really been a pleasure.
Great. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll look forward to seeing you next time.